Poor Wile E. Coyote. So many Saturday mornings of my life. Did you watch a lot of Wile E. Coyote and the Roadrunner like I did? It became obvious to me that he would never have Roadrunner for dinner. Chuck Jones was the creator of Wile E. Coyote, that part of Looney Tunes. And he, starting in 1949, began to put those together. And he had 9 rules. Chuck Jones, the creator of the Wile E. Coyote Roadrunner strip, or those cartoons, had 9. He had 9 rules for the Roadrunner and Wile E. Coyote. First one: the Roadrunner cannot harm the coyote except by going beep beep. And that was true, wasn't it? He never did. That was rule. These are Jones's, the creator's rules for Wile E. Coyote and the Roadrunner. Secondly: no outside force can harm the coyote, only his own ineptitude or the failure of Acme products. So there was never anyone else that got involved. It was really just his own ineptitude and the products that he bought from Acme. You and I get them from Amazon. He got them from Acme. Rule number 3: the coyote could stop anytime, except that he was a fanatic. And a fanatic is one who redoubles his effort when he's forgotten his aim. So it didn't matter that he was never able to be successful. He was just going to keep doing what he was doing without any results. 4th rule: no dialogue ever. No conversation, just beep, beep, that's it. No other dialogue. Rule number 5: the Roadrunner must stay on the road. Otherwise, logically, he would not be a Roadrunner. Rule number 6: all the action must be confined to the natural environment of the two characters somewhere out in the Southwest American desert. They never were anywhere else. 7th, all materials, tools, weapons, or mechanical conveniences must be obtained from Acme. I wonder where he got the catalog from. Rule number 8, whenever possible, make gravity the coyote's greatest enemy. I love the way they fell, because his whole body didn't fall at once, right? Part of his body would fall, and the other part still kind of suspended up in midair. And lastly, the coyote is always more humiliated than harmed by his failures. Those were Jones's. Thanks, Kyle. You can take that away. Those were Jones's rules for the coyote and Roadrunner, Wile E. Coyote. I think there's a bit of a similarity as I think about Esther chapters 6, 7, and 8. We'll finish up chapter 6 tonight, all of chapter 7, the first couple of verses of chapter 8. There's significant similarities between Wile E. Coyote and Haman. Landon Dowden, in his commentary on Esther in the Christ-Centered Exposition series, brought that out. And so I was encouraged to think about Wile E. Coyote again this week. Mordecai refused to bow to Haman, but didn't really pose any threat to him. The Roadrunner didn't pose any threat to Wile E. Coyote. For Haman, Mordecai's refusal to honor him was like the Roadrunner's beep, beep in Wile E. Coyote's ears. He just hated it. He hated the sound of that. It really ground on his nerves. No outside force caused Haman more harm than Haman's own selfishness and wickedness. And like Wile E. Coyote, Haman can't seem to stop. He can't seem to stop pursuing what he desperately wants. You'll remember, I imagine, as we left Esther last week, Mordecai had resumed his place at the king's gate after his little parade with Haman leading the parade. Haman had run home, you remember, to share his humiliation with his wife and his friends. And they gave him some advice, and Haman didn't have very long to consider the dire predictions of his wife and friends, because in chapter 6, verse 14, he is summoned. Esther, chapter 6, verse 14. While they were yet talking with him, the king's eunuchs arrived and hurried to bring Haman to the feast that Esther had prepared. This is not the first time that Haman has been rushed away. You'll remember back in chapter 5, verse 5, at least in my Bible, I don't have to turn a page, but 5:5, the king said, "Bring Haman quickly so we may do as Esther had asked," when he was invited to her first feast. Chapter 6, verse 10. When Haman gave King Ahasuerus good advice about how to honor a great man, the king said to Haman in 6:10, "Hurry, take the robes and the horse and do what you said for Mordecai." So Haman is used to being rushed along. This time he's rushed along to another banquet, a banquet that he had been looking forward to. You remember this? He was really looking forward to Esther's second banquet, a banquet with the king and the queen. But as he goes there this time, his wife and his friend's words are ringing in his ears. Remember what they said to him? Zeresh and his friends, chapter 6, verse 13. They said to him, "If Mordecai, before whom you have begun to fall, is of the Jewish people, you will not overcome him, but will surely fall before him." So he heads off to the feast, to the party at Esther's place, but with a bit of dread in his mind. I wonder what Haman already knew. Of course, we don't know this. Does Haman already know about Esther's Jewishness? Does Haman already know that Mordecai is connected to Esther? All these questions that I have as I think my way through the book of Esther, because unlike Larry Cook, I've not read ahead. I was walking past him in the aisle today, and he says, "I read ahead." So Haman is summoned to this party, this feast with Esther and Ahasuerus, the king. And Ahasuerus begins at the beginning of chapter 7 and offers again the same thing he had offered back in chapter 5. Chapter 7, verse 1. "So the king and Haman went in to feast with Queen Esther. And on the second day," this is the second party, "as they were drinking wine after the feast, the king again said to Esther, 'What is your wish, Queen Esther? It shall be granted you, and what is your request? Even to half of my kingdom it shall be fulfilled.'" He'd made a very similar offer back in chapter 5, verses 5 and 6. The difference here is that he calls her Queen Esther, where before he just called her, he didn't call her anything. He said to Esther, "What is your wish?" Here he specifically, as it's narrated for us, calls her Queen Esther. And Esther's response is telling. I don't know what Ahasuerus knew about Esther's Jewishness before now. I don't know what Haman knew about Esther's Jewishness before now, but it's all going to come out in the open. Revelation is going to occur. Verse 3 of chapter 7. "Queen Esther answered, 'If I have found favor in your sight, O king, and if it please the king, let my life be granted me for my wish and my people for my request. For we have been sold, I and my people, to be destroyed, to be killed, and to be annihilated. If we had been sold merely as slaves, men and women, I would have been silent, for our affliction is not to be compared with the loss to the king.'" Details are flowing out in a hurry. Esther's ethnicity is now, I think, obvious to King Ahasuerus, at least if he has any memory of the edict that was laid out in his name months ago. Ahasuerus learns that the Jews are slated for elimination. I'm not really sure what he understood when Haman executed that edict or put out that edict in his name. I love to listen to Esther. What sweet rhetoric. Esther uses words in a very crafty and intelligent way. She begins, "O king, he's the one, after all, who brought their relationship into existence, right?" She says, "My people are slated for genocide. My people." She's now cheerfully and clearly revealing that she's connected to the Jews and identifies herself with her people. She uses the words from the edict that Haman had written when she says there in verse 4, "We've been sold to be destroyed, to be killed, and to be annihilated." Those are the very words that were in the edict as it was issued. And I think to myself, Esther is sucking the king in, isn't she? She's bringing him to see her side of the story. In the same way, you remember what Nathan did with King David in 2 Samuel chapter 12. I'm going to hold my place in Esther and turn there. I'll invite you to if you want to. If you don't want to, fine. Just sit there and listen. You'll have to trust me as I read it. 2 Samuel chapter 12. You remember chapter 11 of 2 Samuel recounts David's sin with Bathsheba. He not only committed adultery with her, but he also had her husband murdered. And then after this, in 2 Samuel chapter 12, Yahweh sent Nathan to David. And he came to him and said to him, "There were two men in a certain city, the one rich, the other poor. The rich man had very many flocks and herds, but the poor man had nothing but one little ewe lamb which he had bought. He brought it up, and it grew up with him and with his children. It used to eat of his morsel and drink from his cup and lie in his arms. It was like a daughter to him. Now there came a traveler to the rich man, and he, the rich man, was unwilling to take one of his own flock or herd to prepare for the guest who had come to him, but he took the poor man's lamb and prepared it for the man who had come to him. And David's anger was greatly kindled against that man, and he said to Nathan, "As the Lord lives, the man who's done this deserves to die, and he shall restore the lamb fourfold because he did this thing and because he had no pity." And Nathan, having already sucked David in, Nathan said to David, "Thou art the man. You're the man." In the same way, it seems to me, Esther is doing this with Ahasuerus. She's bringing him in to see her side of the story, stoking an anger in Ahasuerus that will have a result that'll be really quite pleasing to us, I think, or at least to me. I'll see if you're pleased with it in a minute. There's considerable danger for Esther still, in spite of her well-planned speech. Do you remember how Ahasuerus sometimes responds a bit violently? Back in chapter 1, Esther's predecessor, Queen Vashti, she responded to his command in a less than favorable way. And what did he do to her? Eliminated her from the court, right? Got rid of her. So there's, I'm sure, still a bit of danger for Esther. So Esther is revealed. She's now laying out a plot against her people. And I want you to notice how Ahasuerus asks a question, and she answers in verses 5 and 6. She's now related to him that the Jews are slated for elimination. And then in verse 5 of chapter 7 of Esther, the king Ahasuerus said to Queen Esther, "Who is he and where is he who has dared to do this?" I don't know whether Ahasuerus can't remember what happened earlier on or if he just had no role in the edict in the first place. And Esther said, "A foe and enemy, this wicked Haman." Then Haman was terrified before the king and the queen. Esther wisely presents Haman as Ahasuerus' enemy, right? After all, Haman had planned to execute Ahasuerus' loyal servant who had protected him from an assassination plot. The fact that God arranged for Ahasuerus not to be able to sleep the night before and the books to be brought off the shelf and the right portion to be read, all of that puts Ahasuerus in a place where he's really concerned about Mordecai. And now that it's related to him that Haman sought not only the Jews' elimination, but Mordecai's death as well, Esther's really wise in presenting Haman as an enemy to Ahasuerus. So Ahasuerus says, "Who is this that's done this to your people?" He's distancing himself, the king is, from the edict. Wise man. I wonder, as soon as Esther says, "This wicked Haman," what does Haman's face look like? I'm guessing the color changed a bit. I'm guessing the color drained from his face and the lunch drained from his stomach. My guess is he's in trouble. He is physically in trouble at this point. The world is spinning, so it seems, around him. "Well, it's too late to turn back now, Esther. You're all in here." And she responds, "This wicked Haman." It's not going to go well for him. He's understandably terrified. He's been reading the writing on the wall. Somebody said that at missions committee meeting this afternoon, speaking of another Persian king. He understands that this is not going to end well. So look what happens. Ahasuerus gets really angry. Verse 7. "The king arose in his wrath from the wine drinking and went into the palace garden. But Haman stayed to beg for his life from Queen Esther. For Haman saw that harm was determined against him by the king. And the king returned from the palace garden to the place where they were drinking wine as Haman was falling on the couch where Esther was." This does not look good. Why do you suppose Ahasuerus went out into the garden? To cool off? Count to 10. Okay, maybe. I don't know why he'd want to cool off. He's never demonstrated any willingness to cool off in the past. Any other ideas? I don't have an answer to this question. I'm just thinking my way through the text like you are now. Unless you read ahead, Larry. Any other ideas why he went to the garden? Yeah, to clear his head a bit and think his way through that. Again, that doesn't seem like the Ahasuerus I've come to know and dislike. I'm not sure he thinks through most anything, but he goes out to the garden, maybe just to give Haman an opportunity to hang himself. I don't know. I'm a skeptic when it comes to Haman, of course. Maybe he didn't know what to do. What has Ahasuerus been doing throughout the whole book of Esther? Anytime he comes up to a point where he has to make a decision, Al? Takes a drink of wine and asks for somebody to help him. Somebody else make this decision for me. I'm not sure. You know, typically at this point, you'd expect him to pick up his wine glass and say to some trusted advisor, say, Haman, who happens to be in the room with him, what should I do now? Not going to do that. Yeah, get his nerve up. Yeah, number two in the kingdom. Well, Haman has figured out that his goose is cooked. He's in trouble. And he falls on the couch. Why is he falling on Esther's couch? Because he's appealing for her, I think, to save him. Help me here. Of course, Ahasuerus comes back in at a most inopportune time for Haman. Ahasuerus walks back into the room and here's Haman falling upon Queen Esther. And I love the way that Ahasuerus responds to this. By the way, Haman is doing what on the couch? Falling. What did Zeresh and his friends say he was doing back in chapter 6, verse 13? Remember that? 6:13, they said, if you are falling before this Jew, Mordecai, that they were speaking better than they knew, weren't they? So here he is, indeed, falling on the couch. I don't know whether that's an attempt to bring things together in a literary way by the author of Esther or not, but it was interesting to me to see that verb come up again, falling there. Circumstances, coincidences seem to have conspired against Haman. Is that really what's going on? Or is God providentially arranging Haman's demise? Whatever Haman's doing on Esther's couch, would he have been doing it if the king was in the room? Probably not. Is Ahasuerus unfairly accusing Haman of molesting Esther? You don't want to say yes, but he is, right? Normally, it would bother me to see Haman unjustly accused. But in this case, I'll make an exception. Because I've come to dislike him intensely. I have no use for Haman. Maybe that's just the evil, wicked side of me showing up. I'm not sure. Could Esther have clarified things? Could Esther have said to Ahasuerus, oh no, that's not what he was doing. He was not attempting to molest me. He was appealing for mercy. Could Esther have done that? And she didn't. Does that bother you? Doesn't bother me either. And I think that's just a recognition of how much I dislike Haman and how much I appreciate the way God has arranged this whole day. I find myself quietly applauding her silence. I'm not sure whether it's just ironic or ironic and just that Haman is going to suffer the consequences of a false accusation because he's been making them all along. And so now he gets to see what that's like. Well, look what happens beginning in the middle of verse 8. So the king comes in and finds Haman falling on the couch where Esther was, middle of verse 8. And the king said, will he even assault the queen in my presence, in my own house? As the word left the mouth of the king, they covered Haman's face. Then Harbona, one of the eunuchs in attendance on the king, said, moreover, the gallows or the pole, the Hebrew word is tree, the gallows that Haman has prepared for Mordecai, whose word saved the king, is standing at Haman's house, 50 cubits or 75 feet high. And the king said in verse 10, hang him on that. So they hanged Haman on the gallows that he had prepared for Mordecai. Then the wrath of the king abated. Some official comes along and covers Haman's face. Earlier that day, Haman had run home in shame with his face covered. He pulled his own jacket over his face. This time somebody else covers his face. What do you suppose they're covering his face for? Because he's on his way to the gallows, right? He is done. Shame is what's being shown. You remember Harbona from chapter 1? This Harbona, who in verse 9 of chapter 7 gives advice to the king, was one of the eunuchs who gave advice to the king on the day when Vashti was not being cooperative, back in chapter 1, verse 10. Mehuman, Biztha, Harbona, Bigtha, Abagtha, Zether, and Carcass. So he's been around the king for some time. How do you suppose Harbona knew about Haman's gallows and his plan to put Mordecai on them? Doesn't that seem odd to you that Harbona knows the plan? Or maybe more odd, why does Ahasuerus not know? What do you think, Larry? Coffee shop. Thank you. Why is it that you remember those things? That's okay. I'll buy that. I'm not sure where we started with the coffee shop, but we've been there, seems like week by week. So obviously, Harbona knows, Ahasuerus seems to be ignorant of it, and Harbona makes it clear that Haman is not just going to try to exterminate the Jews, but also was one who was going to kill a now recognized benefactor of the king, and he's hanged on his own gallows. Is that not sweet irony? What could you possibly want better than this? Last week, Haman and Mordecai changed places, right? Mordecai was honored, Haman led the procession. This week, Haman and Mordecai are changing places. Who was the gallows prepared for? Mordecai. Who ends up on it? Haman does, hanged on his own gallows. And even here again, Ahasuerus can't seem to make decisions on his own, but he relies on a trusted advisor. Harbona this time tells him what to do. This keeps happening. Ahasuerus does not seem like a strong king to me. And hanging Haman on his own gallows abates the king's wrath. You see that at the end of verse 10? The wrath of the king abated. He feels a whole lot better. So Ahasuerus' wrath against Haman is abated. How about God's wrath against Haman? For how long will God's wrath be poured out upon Haman? Yeah, forever. I think death is no escape for God's wrath. That ought to serve as motivation for us, because you and I have friends. Some of us have family members. We have people we come to know week by week and day to day who don't know Christ. And for them, the wrath of God hangs over them. It is incumbent upon us to share the sweet truth of the gospel, that they might come to know Christ, and therefore let him pay the price for their sins. Let him be the propitiatory sacrifice for them. God's wrath hangs over them. We get a little bit of resolution here at the beginning of chapter 8. Chapter 8, verse 1. On that day, King Ahasuerus gave to Queen Esther the house of Haman. That is the estate of Haman, the enemy of the Jews. And Mordecai came before the king, for Esther had told what he was to her. And the king took off his signet ring, which he had taken from Haman, and gave it to Mordecai. And Esther set Mordecai over the house of Haman. It's almost like we could now, like Simeon in Luke's gospel, we could go home in peace now, because all is well. All the tension has been resolved. No, it hasn't. There's still a bit of tension that remains, right? We're encouraged that Esther has shown back up in the story. She receives the estate of Haman, turns it over apparently to Mordecai. She reveals to the king that Mordecai is her uncle or cousin or whatever you call him. It's like she's saying to Ahasuerus, look, we're kind of a package deal here. And Ahasuerus says, I need a right-hand man. You got anybody in mind? Esther says, I know just the man. And Mordecai, who has proven his loyalty to the king, is now richly rewarded. But what is it that Esther and Mordecai need more than anything else? Safety for the people. Salvation for the Jews. So not all has been fixed, at least yet. Proverbs 26:27. Don't turn there, I'll tell you what it says. Whoever digs a pit will fall into it, and a stone will come back on him who starts it rolling. I thought of that stone rolling when I thought about Wile E. Coyote, because he inevitably placed big stones up at the top of some high place, right? And inevitably, how did it always happen this way? He's chasing the roadrunner down the road. The stone rolls down just as it's supposed to, but it never rolls over the roadrunner. It always rolls over our friend Wile E. The proverb says, a stone will come back on him who starts it rolling. Whoever digs the pit will fall into it. That's certainly proven to be true for Haman here tonight in Esther chapter 7. Does this execution of the would-be executioner seem right to you? Are you bothered by it? Are you really? Because it seems wrong to execute a would-be executioner? Oh, so what bothers you about it? Oh, did you say yes? You didn't say yes? Somebody said yes. That wasn't you. Did you throw your voice? I want to be bothered by it because it seems like it might be overkill, but again, he has demonstrated his willingness to kill all the Jews. Esther took charge, dealt with Haman. She took quite a risk. But the edict to exterminate the Jews still hangs over her head. I wonder if there's a resolution in the offing. Don't tell me, Larry. I don't want to know yet. The architect of the edict is dead, but the edict is still active. Because after all, here's how it works with the Medes and Persians. Once you write a law, it has to be carried out, no matter what else happens. So really, only the conflict between Haman and Mordecai has been resolved. I wonder, will the Esther story end with saved alone? You remember Anna Spafford got that telegram, right? Or she sent that telegram. It was Horatio Spafford. You remember Horatio Spafford? I remember for sure. We're traveling across the Atlantic for a much-needed vacation. He was attending to business, I think, in Chicago. And they preceded him across the Atlantic, and the ship they were on struck another ship, and it sank in like 12 minutes. And Mrs. Spafford survived, but all the daughters perished. She cabled back from Europe, saved alone. I wonder, is Esther going to send that kind of a telegram? Saved alone. Or will all the Jews somehow be preserved? Don't tell me. I want to wait till I get there. That was a rhetorical question, Margaret. Don't forget here that the book of Esther is more about God, what God is doing, than it is about what Ahasuerus is doing, what Haman is doing, what Esther is doing, what Mordecai is doing. True or false? God has fixed every outcome already. You apparently have a high view of God's sovereignty. True or false? God can only act with our help. Okay. Let me try again. True or false? God generally chooses to use us to carry out the things which he has decreed. That seems reasonable. I think we can hold to a high view of God's sovereignty, that he's not caught by surprise. But at the same time, he shows himself as one who uses humans to accomplish his acts. He's doing that here, is he not? Did he not use Esther's bravery to inform Ahasuerus of Haman's evilness? It's amazing to me that Ahasuerus has to keep asking his advisors what to do next. Guess who doesn't need to do that? God. Yeah. Is it Isaiah chapter 40? You're a fan of Isaiah 40, Roger. Right? Verses, is it 3 and 4 that you like to quote? Oh, 40:31. Thank you. I'm in Isaiah 40, verse 13. I'm only just going to read a pair of verses. Who's measured the Spirit of the Lord, or what man shows him his counsel? What man is there that gives God counsel? The answer expected is none. Verse 14, whom did he consult? Who made God understand? Who taught him the path of justice? Who taught him knowledge? Who showed him the way of understanding? The answer to that question is no one. So unlike Ahasuerus, who doesn't seem to be able to make any decision on his own, we serve a God in contrast to him who has the end figured out from the beginning. The iniquities of the wicked ensnare him. He is held fast in the cords of his sin. That's Proverbs 5:22. God's working us all out. Or at least he's working some of it out. I'm eager to see where we go from here, but I refuse to read ahead. So I'll be eager to see whether there is salvation for the Jews as a whole. At least we've gotten Esther and Mordecai out of the woods. We'll see what happens to the rest as we continue. I want to take just a moment and pray with you. Father, we've seen a contrast between Ahasuerus and you. You're a God who does not need advice. We've seen a contrast tonight, Father, between Haman and you. You are pure and holy. Haman was as wicked as the day is long. We have seen, Father, fallible human beings making decisions that they, from their perspective, were making in their day-to-day lives, but decisions which played into your sovereign plan. And for that, we're just going to praise you again. We come to this text with a predisposition to believe in your sovereignty, and then that informs how we read it. We praise you for being a providential God. Don't ever let us lose sight of that. Even when we finally get to the end of Esther's story, don't let us lose sight of how you have arranged our lives. That gives us confidence this week as we seek to serve you, not in our strength. We serve you relying on you, but we do engage as you've told us to. Give us, we pray, such courage in Christ's name. Amen. Thank you.